This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran arrests a number of Israeli Mossad agents who enter the country to carry out acts of sabotage and terrorism in sensitive locations. Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a military operation in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. A state of emergency is in place in parts of the U.S. state of California, and that after a wildfire prompts massive evacuations. Live from our Tehran headquarters, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, Iran says it's arrested a network of agents working for the Israeli Mossad spy agency. Iran Intelligence Ministry said in a statement the network's members entered the country from Iraq's Kurdistan region while carrying advanced equipment and strong explosives. The ministry added the forces arrested them before they were able to carry out acts of sabotage and terrorist operations in Iran's sensitive locations. Israeli intelligence services have a history of direct involvement in terrorist acts against the Islamic Republic. The regime has been behind many terror attacks and other sabotaging acts inside Iran. The Iranian president says that a breakthrough on the revival of the 2015 deal is possible if other signatories to the accord provide guarantees that Iran will enjoy its economic benefits. Raisi made the announcement during a phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron. The Iranian president noted the negotiations will bear fruits if the parties to JCPOA uphold their obligations. He also slammed the recent anti-Iran resolution by the IAEA's Board of Governors and said that the move damaged political trust. Raisi also said that the U.S. sanctions on Iran are detrimental to the global economy. The French president also vowed to continue efforts to help parties to the talks reach an agreement. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation Standing Committee on Scientific and Cooperation has awarded two Iranian scholars as winners of the COMSTEC 2022 for chemistry and best scientific book. Salman Kujuri has a report.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation Standing Committee on Scientific and Cooperation, COMSTEC of the OIC, has awarded two Iranian scholars as the winners of COMSTEC Lifetime Achievement Award in Chemistry 2021 and COMSTEC Award for Best Scientific Book. Ali Mousavi Movahedi of the Institute of Biochemistry and Biophysics from the University of Tehran won Khan Lifetime Achievement Award in Chemistry 2021, and Ismail Ghavanlu as Associate Professor of Shiraz University has won Comstock Award for Best Scientific Book.
I've been studying and working on the structures and the functions of proteins throughout my life. This is important because all human activities are actually done by proteins. As a result of 40 years of studies and research, I was honored to receive the Comstock Lifetime Achievement Award.
Our book is about nanostructures. It is the result of years of research on nanomechanics. A good thing about this book is its writing style, which can serve as a reference book for researchers and also a good educational book for students.
Comstock Awards are conferred biennially in basic sciences and in excellence in science and technology to recognize the outstanding research work carried out by scientists who are citizens of or working in OIC member states.
In 2021, more than 77,000 scientific articles were registered from Iran, and our country ranks first in the production of scientific articles among countries in the Muslim world and the region. Despite the sanctions imposed on Iran, international activities and cooperation have increased, and our scientists are not limited by geographical and political borders.
Comstock, the Ministerial Standing Committee on Scientific and Technological Cooperation of the OIC, was established by the Third Islamic Summit of OIC, held at Mecca, Saudi Arabia, in January 1981.
According to global reports, Iran ranks 15th in the world in terms of science production. And the most important research areas of Iran have been medicine, engineering, and material science, respectively. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Another deadly Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. At least two Palestinians have been killed in the northern city of Nablus. The two men were aged 29 and 22. The Palestinian Red Crescent saying that 12 other people were also injured, one of them seriously. Palestinian reporters have described the raid as a full-blown military invasion. They say Israeli snipers were positioned on buildings from which they fired live ammunition and stun grenades. Israeli forces have also stormed the flashpoint city of Jenin. The army conducts near daily raids and arrest operations in Palestinian towns in the occupied West Bank. The attacks often result in casualties. Israeli forces have killed at least 50 Palestinians in occupied territory since late March. Several journalists, writers, politicians, and activists have gathered in the Lebanese southern town of Nagora, where they voiced support for the Lebanese negotiating team, in the meantime, in the maritime dispute with the Israeli regime.
A gathering of Lebanese journalists and activists was held in the South Lebanon town of Nagora to protest against Israel's extraction activities in the disputed waters.
We are so powerful, we can fight, we can go to war in case the enemy wants a war, unless we get our rights and our wealth in the sea and on the land.
Former head of the Lebanese negotiating team believed that any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the party.
One of the strongest point is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation of for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form of diplomatic or political or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker Minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July.
We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed. Are blocks 10 and 9, both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The more than 500 firefighters are working in the U.S. to extinguish a wildfire that has ripped through thousands of acres in California. Over a dozen properties already destroyed or battle damaged, emergency personnel trying to evacuate residents and protect structures. Some 6,000 people evacuated as the fire remains 0% contained as of Saturday evening, local time. The blaze has left behind ashes, gutted vehicles, and twisted remains of property in its wake. It broke out after a heat wave swept across multiple regions, pushing up temperatures. According to the officials, the fire could take a week to contain. Now, Hungary is urging the EU to change its strategies on Ukraine, saying that Western sanctions on Moscow have failed.
Western strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
The Hungarian Prime Minister says the sanctions were aimed at destabilizing Russia's leadership in the war. He says, however, Ukraine will never win the war this way, as the Russian army has asymmetrical dominance. Viktor Orban says the war can come to an end only through peace talks between Russia and the U.S. Orban stressed that Hungary is unwilling to support the EU's limitations on Russian gas imports. He warned that this would undermine European economy. The bloc has imposed a wave of sanctions on Russia, targeting its key sectors. Record high temperatures are causing France to take increasingly drastic measures amid the West sanctions campaign against Russia. Citizens are being asked to conserve power with energy cuts this winter already being called a certainty. Ryan Mazahari has more from Paris.
Due to their decision to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine, France and the European Union are desperately trying to build energy stocks ahead of this winter. However, a record heat wave has created a surge in energy consumption, and that's prompted the government to informally call for the rationing of electricity. Citizens have been pushed to make an effort by cutting off Wi-Fi, unplugging appliances, and going without air conditioning. Many in poor neighborhoods say they expect their streets to go dark earlier and for their social services to be affected first. The West's sanctions campaign against Russia continues to force the average household into paying a steep price.
It's very difficult to see this crisis getting better by 2023. Finding alternative sources for gas and petrol will cause higher prices. Renewable energy will be more expensive. France isn't a big coal producer. France is already depleting its petrol and gas stocks. So every choice away from Russian energy is going to increase energy prices.
In order to have more control over the national energy grid, this week the government announced that they will totally renationalize the company Electricity of France. The energy giant runs all of the nation's nuclear power plants. Nuclear power provides nearly 70% of France's energy, the most of any country in the world. But a recent series of outages have caused nuclear power output to drop to its lowest level in nearly 30 years. Leaders of French energy corporations recently said that energy cuts are certain for this winter and that prolonged cold spells may threaten social and political cohesion.
The best solution is to negotiate with Russia to end the war in Ukraine. But we also need the leaders of the European Union to stop living in an isolated fishbowl where pushing for more war is a good idea. This energy and economic crisis is affecting all citizens.
A proposal to give the European Union the right to impose mandatory gas rationing across the bloc's 27 member countries was immediately shot down by the nations of Southern Europe this week. They called it the farthest-reaching power grab by Brussels this year. And it was especially controversial because individual national vetoes were not allowed under an emergency procedure employed by the leaders of the European Union. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Britain's ruling Conservative Party has got embroiled in the new Islamophobia scandal, and that after a right-wing tabloid revealed that Number 10 has placed a boycott on a senior mainstream Muslim organization. The ban was originally resolved in 2010. Still, it's remained an ongoing obstacle for Muslim representation in British political circles. Robert Carter explains in more details in the next report.
Anger has been caused amongst British Muslims after a right-wing newspaper attacked Conservative leadership contender Penny Mordaunt for flouting a so-called government boycott of Britain's largest Muslim group. Following the article's release earlier this week, Muslim activists and even a Muslim Labour MP condemned the government over their admission of the ban. The boycott centres on the Muslim Council of Britain, which claims to be the UK's biggest umbrella organisation of Muslim groups. In 2009, the then Labour government indeed cut ties with the group over a row regarding comments criticising Israeli aggression on Palestine. Although the ban was reversed a year later, successive Tory governments have continued to enforce it without much explanation. Onlookers believe the so-called policy is less about combating extremism and more about gagging legitimate Muslim voices.
Here we have an institution that represents very well and not extreme and, you know, having a variety of individuals, educated and professional, and coming across to give their views for, you know, the Muslims that do live in the United Kingdom. And here we have even that to be stopped. So it's really sad, it's quite disappointing, and I also would like to understand why that is actually happening. And once again, it's a target for Muslims. Yet they are showing, not just by their voice, but now in action, that they're actually doing worse and calling out others for being in that way when they are doing it themselves.
Representatives from the Muslim Council of Britain have informed Press TV that they were not in a position where they could further comment on the story at this time. However, in comments that were released earlier in the week, the council did admit that since 2009's ban by the then Labour government, the council and its representatives have met up with some elected members different parties, including the Conservatives. So questions still surround why this boycott is still being enforced by the current government. Those questions may take some time to answer. Robert Carter, London.
In South Korea, activists and their supporters have gathered for a peace festival near the demilitarized zone. They're seeking an end to the Korean War and to replace the armistice with a peace treaty, demanding politicians to do more. Not that, as the new Korean president has strengthened his country's alliance with the U.S. and plans joint military drills for next month. Frank Smith has the story.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together 80 million people for peace. Let's get together, people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because everyone wants to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. New South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a hard line with North Korea, boosting the country's military and strengthening its alliance with the United States, with joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises planned for next month. Advocates for peace, like those gathered here today, have an uphill battle. Frank Smith, Imjingak, South Korea.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Mubahale, triumph of the rationality of Islam. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and felicitations to you on an auspicious occasion. Today, the 24th of Dhul Hijjah, is the anniversary of a memorable and very unique dialogue in the history of civilization. It was between the Islam and Christianity. The Christians were led by their archbishops, while the Muslims were led by the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to mankind, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we go to the details, here is Ayah 64 of Surah Nisa of the Noble Quran, in which God commands his prophet to tell the other party, say, O people of the book, come to a word common between us and you, that we will worship no one but Allah, and that we will not ascribe any partner to him, and that we will not take each other as lords besides Allah. But if they turn away, say, be witness that we are Muslims. The ayah that we recited to you removes any doubt about Islam's rationality and exposes the takfiris, masquerading as Muslims and jihadists, to stir up violence, bloodshed, vandalism, and massacre of followers of other creeds and religions as nothing but godless terrorists. Islam is the religion of rationality and reason. The Prophet of Islam and his infallible Ahlul Bayt proved this time and again. They emphasize the importance of dialogue to stress truth. Today, when there is loud talk of dialogue among civilizations and discussions among different creeds, although without any tangible result because of the apparent lack of courage of the contending parties to acknowledge the positive points, let us turn our attention to a memorable parley held over a millennium and four centuries ago that stands as a beacon of light for all sincere debaters. As we said earlier, today, the 14th of Dhul Hijjah, happens to be the anniversary of that dynamic dialogue that confirmed beyond an iota of doubt what truth and righteousness means. It was indeed a decisive debate, yet despite 3 days of discussions, a dead end appeared to be the result because of the reluctance of the opposing party knowledgeable theologians that had traveled all the way from Najran in the southwestern part of Arabian Peninsula to Medina in the north in their quest for determining the truth. Engaged in a peaceful parley in Masjid al-Nabi, or the Prophet's Mosque, was the Christian delegation of pontiffs led by Archbishop Abdul Masih, who, despite the claim to monotheism, insisted that Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, was the Son of God. The visitors to Medina appeared to be stalled when it came to rational debate, although they weren't able to give any convincing proofs as to how the one and only omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent creator, who has neither form nor needs, could have an offspring or an associate to run the universe. The Prophet of Islam pointed out to the pontiffs the case of Adam and Eve and how they were created without parents by God, who merely says, be, and the beings, including Jesus, the virgin born, take shape and form. He explained to the Christians that Prophet Jesus never made such a blasphemous claim that would have certainly jeopardized his reformatory mission. Moreover, Tawhid or monotheism means the indivisible unity of God Almighty, who is far glorious to possess the characteristics of his creatures, Anyhow, it was important for this lively dialogue not to remain inconclusive. God Almighty had his own plans, so that till doomsday, the rationality of the universal message of Islam remains above doubts and disputes. Prompt came the revelation from the celestial heavens to the Prophet of Islam to challenge the Christians to invoke divine malediction, which is mubahale in Arabic, if they are confident of what they claim. Ayah 59 to 61 of Surah Nisa say in this regard, "Indeed, the case of Jesus with God is like the case of Adam. He created him from dust, then said to him, 'Be,' and he was. This is the truth from your Lord, so do not be among the doubters. Should anyone argue with you concerning him after the knowledge that has come to you, say, 'Come, let us call our sons and your sons, our women and your women, our souls and your souls. Then let us invoke and call down Allah's curse upon the liars.'" The two sides prepared for a showdown to invoke divine curse. On the morrow, the Christian threw elaborate rituals to their Trinity and the Prophet with a simple prayer of thanksgiving to the omnipresent Lord. That night, the Prophet covered himself with a cloak and was joined in it by his two little grandsons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, his daughter Hazrat Fatima Zahra, and his son-in-law, Imam Ali, peace upon them. At this moment, Archangel Gabriel descended, giving tidings that God Almighty has created everything in the heavens and the earth for the sake of this blessed group. He conveyed the divine revelation in the form of Ayah 33 of Surah Rum of the Noble Quran, which reads, "Indeed, Allah desires to ward off all impurity from you, Ahlul Bayt, and keep you thoroughly pure." This ayah was confirmation of the Ahlul Bayt's infallible identity for the Prophet's wives and their kith and kin, and an indicator of the manifest miracle to occur the next day. The rest is history. How the pontiffs of Najran assembled with their flock at the appointed place, and how awestruck they became when the Prophet calmly arrived for the challenge to invoke divine wrath on the liars, but without any of his companions and with only his nearest and dearest family members, that is, daughter Hazrat Fatima Zahra, son-in-law Imam Ali, and two little grandsons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them. These were the immaculate Ahlul Bayt, or the nearest and dearest of his blessed family, the Ahlul Bayt, whose pristine purity has been vouchsafed by God Almighty in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab. The Christians realized that, without the least doubt, these fabulous five were the pride of Jesus and his Virgin Mother Mary, peace upon them. The awestruck Christians of Najran realized the truth. They were beholding enlightened visages that would instantly bring the wrath of God if this blessed group of five were to lift their hands to heaven. The Christians wisely withdrew the challenge and made peace, thereby proving to posterity the folly of opposing the Ahlad Bayt. The challenge was instantly withdrawn. Islam had a resounding triumph. In the words of the Abdul Masih, faces so radiant and pristinely pure that God would make mountains move from their places if they were to invoke divine curse on their opponents. But how could the Ahlul Bayt curse mankind? They never cursed anyone. Despite being oppressed, persecuted, and mercilessly martyred after the passing away of the Prophet, not by Christians but by persons who claimed to be Muslims. The reference for the Ahlul Bayt is considered by God as a token of gratitude for Muslims for the selfless endeavors of the Prophet in delivering them from the darkness of disbelief, as Ayah 23 of Surah Shura says. Mubahala is thus an undeniable manifestation for mankind that the rationality of Islam will remain incomplete and unable to win over minds and souls in debates and dialogues, however sincere the intention, without the Ahlul Bayt. The last living member of the Ahlul Bayt is Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, whose reappearance the world is eagerly expecting to red planet Earth of all exploitation, enlighten nations, as the Christians of Najran discovered, and to establish the global government of peace, justice, and equity, with Prophet Jesus serving as his lieutenant. Mubahala also proves that those calling themselves Takfiris, Salafis, Wahhabis, etc., have no relation to Islam and message of peace and rationality, because the Islam of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt doesn't call for wanton killing, destruction of civilization, violence, or bloodshed. The day of Mubahala thus left a lasting impression on the minds of mankind of the inseparable link between the Prophet's progeny and the Book of God. Perhaps many of the companions of the Prophet may have recalled that day another significant divine revelation in confirmation of the velayat, or the divinely ordained authority of Imam Ali, peace upon him, the first and foremost member of the Ahlul Bayt, on this very same 24th of Dhul-Hajjah a few years ago, when he gave away his ring as alms by indicating with his finger while engrossed in the ritual prayer in the Prophet's mosque in Medina, when a beggar pleaded for help. God confirmed this highly generous act of the Imam by revealing Ayah 55 and 56 of Surah Ma'idah, which read, "Your guardian is only Allah, His Prophet, and the faithful, who maintains the prayer and gives the zakat while in ruku. Whoever takes for his guardian Allah, the Prophet, and the faithful, should know that the Hezbollah is indeed the victorious."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The beginning of the end. Part 2.
When Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities were targeted in drone attacks, Riyadh could hardly imagine that the consequences of the face-off with Yemen would be so harsh. Saudi Arabia is Yemen's largest neighbor and the largest country in the Arabian Peninsula. Most of the country is comprised of vast deserts, Saudi Arabia owes its significance among Arab and Islamic countries to two holy and religious cities of Mecca and Medina. Islam is the birthplace of Saudi Arabia and was exported to other countries. After the discovery of oil, Saudi Arabia gradually became one of the, or I'd better say, the biggest oil exporter in the world. Saudi Arabia's significance today is a combination of the historical significance and its economic weight. Saudi Arabia has always been pivotal in the developments in Yemen, but the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen has many complications. When supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser and Arab nationalists rose up against the ruling of the Zaydis, Saudi Arabia sided with the Zaydis because if Nasser had come to power, it would pose a danger to Arab monarchies. Nasser became Egypt's president after toppling a monarchical rule. He was against Arab and even Iranian monarchs. He had strong socialist tendencies, and at the same time, he would call himself an Arab nationalist. He would fight with Israel and the UK on the one hand, and on the other, he used a different name for the Persian Gulf and claimed that the three Iranian islands belonged to Arabs. After the 9/11 attacks, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had previously toppled the Zaydi rule, got closer to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Riyadh secretly funded al-Qaeda and got closer to Saleh, so Saleh released many al-Qaeda terrorists in return. But the friendly ties faced a major problem. The problem was initiated somewhere far away. A poor man in Tunisia set himself ablaze in front of a government building. It was the beginning of a revolution that spread to many Arab countries. It was the beginning of a new story for Yemen. In 1986, a political group named the Houthi Union was formed in this part of Yemen. Scholars like Mohammed Badreddin al-Houthi and Majid Eddin al-Muyayidi taught subjects about Iran's revolution to the group. Yemeni's interests in the revolution stem from their passion for Islamic teachings. Traditionally, there were people who had lived with those teachings generation after generation, and they naturally welcomed the teachings in the political and social arena. Politically, Hussein was a supporter of the Islamic Republic of Iran. What's more, he supported anti-Israeli Islamic groups like Hezbollah and the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Sayyid Hussein considered Israel as one of the main enemies of Islam. He launched a campaign to ban Israeli and U.S. goods in Yemen. The administration of Ali Abdullah Saleh sensed the danger. An Islamic movement in Yemen, similar to Hezbollah, could be a threat to his long-time rule. Many Houthi youths were arrested on charges of trying to restore the Zaydi government. That was a time when the U.S. faced the 9/11 attacks. After security forces arrested the dissident youth, people took to the streets on February 9, 2011. They blocked roads with rocks and tires and set a police car ablaze. On February 11th, when Yemenis received the news that Hosni Mubarak was toppled in Egypt, the protesters swarmed the streets to demand freedom and the fall of the regime. Ali Abdullah Saleh asked his supporters to stage counter-demonstrations with the traditional daggers and cold weapons. That day was named the Friday of Rage. The Friday of Rage was a turning point. After that day, the revolution spread to 15 other provinces in the country. Things were getting out of hand, and in the spring of 2012, Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab states, who were members of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, introduced a plan for Ali Abdullah Saleh to step down and a new government by the opposition be formed. Saleh didn't resign. After the negotiations, Saleh finally agreed to step down, but after a while, he said as a condition for his resignation, he wanted to remain in power until 2013. On June 3, 2011, Saleh and some government officials in the mosque at the presidential palace were targeted in an assassination attempt. He was taken to Saudi Arabia for treatment. In Saudi Arabia, he agreed to the Saudi plan. Saleh gave up presidency and his deputy, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, claimed power. During this time, the Houthi movement and its leader, Abdul Malik, supported the revolution in Sada'a. Abdul Malik al-Houthi named the movement the Ansarullah. Ansarullah took power in the national dialogue after the revolution and tried to stop the influence of Wahhabis in Yemen's future. Soon, the Ansarullah engaged in a war with Wahhabis in Damaj district in Sada'a province, which was an infiltration point for the Wahhabis. For decades, Saudi Arabia has been the main exporter of extremist Wahhabi and Salafi ideologies. One of the main measures taken by Saudi Arabia has been to build religious schools across the world. Wahhabism is propagated in the schools. Damaj in Sada'a province has been the center of Dar al-Hadith school for a while. It was a Wahhabi center that had been established with Saudi funds and trained over 12,000 Salafi militants. It was one of the largest producers of Salafis in the world. The Salafi tribes rushed to help the religious seminaries and besiege Sada'a. They blocked water, food, and medicine supplies for over 500,000 people who lived in the city. The Ansarullah asked the new Yemeni government to lift the siege, but the tribes that had laid the siege on Sada'a asked the Ansarullah to ease the blockade on Damaj so they would also withdraw. The war spread to Sada'a province. After a while, the army's 310 Brigade got into a conflict with the Ansarullah. Finally, the resistance movement managed to regain control of the Salafi positions and won the war. After a while, the government and Ansarullah made a ceasefire deal, but the Salafi tribes breached the ceasefire once again. Hence, the cycle of war and truce continued. Finally, the Salafi al-Ahmar tribe asked Saudi Arabia for help. Even though Saudi Arabia didn't directly get involved in the war with the Houthis, the positions were clear. However, an incident disturbed the recurring cycle of war and truce. On July 30th, 2014, the administration of Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi removed fuel subsidies and the gasoline and petroleum prices in Yemen, whose population were deep in poverty, skyrocketed. Under the new circumstances, on August 4th, 2014, Abdul Malik al-Houthi called on the people to stage protests against the new government. People answered his call. Protests were staged in many Yemeni provinces by supporters of the Ansarullah movement. Abdul Malik demanded a decrease in fuel prices. The government turned down the request. Army forces swarmed the streets to suppress the second revolution. On September 9, 2014, security forces fired live bullets at protesters in the capital Sana'a and stifled dissent. Following the unrest, Ansarullah deployed forces to the capital. The war started in the capital Sana'a. On September 21, 2014, the government finally backed down and fulfilled the revolutionaries' demands. The government and the revolutionaries signed a peace agreement. They celebrated on the streets, but they weren't aware the conflict wasn't over. While the two sides were bickering over a new prime minister, Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi unilaterally designated his head of office, Ahmad Awad bin Mubarak, as the premier. Ansarullah protested, and Ahmad Awad bin Mubarak couldn't form a government. After a while, the government decided to divide Yemen into six tribal regions. The Houthis didn't accept the proposal either because it would stoke tensions between the south and north. Finally, talks between the government of Hadi and the Ansarullah failed. The Ansarullah forces arrested Ahmad Awad bin Mubarak, Hadi's candidate for vice presidency, on January 17, 2015, and said their goal was to stop a coup. Bin Mubarak had close ties with the U.S. and would constantly go to the U.S. embassy. He was known as the son of the embassy. Ansarullah announced it had obtained documents that showed he was planning to hatch a plot against the Ansarullah leaders and disarm the movement. Hadi put his forces on standby. The Ansarullah arrested Hadi's son, Jalal, and Abdul Malik's forces occupied the Sabah al-Yemen television networks. Ansarullah's supporters in the country grew by leaps and bounds, so the army didn't dare intervene to defend Hadi. But the cycle of conflict and truce in Yemen is endless. In the evening of Monday, January 19, 2015, Ansarullah sat for talks with Hadi, even though it had the upper hand, and struck a deal. Houthi forces agreed to release bin Mubarak and withdrew from some state and military centers. In return, the government had to make amendments to the constitution and ditch the plan to divide the country into the six tribal regions. Only after 3 days, on January 22nd, Hadi resigned. The same day, his cabinet ministers also submitted their resignations. The country's higher-ups sat down to find a solution. What happened that all of a sudden Hadi changed the course of action? What happened that after the agreement, all of a sudden he decided to resign? Only a few hours after his resignation, on Friday, January 23rd, some news came from Saudi Arabia that could solve the mystery. Saudi King Abdullah passed away. In the corridors of power in Saudi Arabia, a silent coup was underway. Even though Salman would be the next king, he was mentally and physically incapable of running an absolute monarchy. This was the man behind the scenes, Mohammed bin Salman, who acted as a new link between the U.S. and Saudis and played the role to push forward Western policies on Yemen. He was still in his 20s when King Salman appointed him as defense minister. He was a person behind the plan to thwart the second revolution and most probably Hadi's sudden resignation.
He Bin Salman formed a coalition to topple the Houthis, imposed a sea blockade on Yemen, and prepared for an all-out war on the Houthis. Hadi was under supervision in his house for a month. He secretly fled from Aden, the capital of South Yemen, on February 21, 2015. Persian Gulf Cooperation Council member states supported him. It meant war was about to break out. The revolutionary forces moved towards Aden and captured several strategic centers. Even though Hadi's forces were supported by bin Salman and Saudi Arabia, they lost their positions one after the other. Persian Gulf Arab states moved their embassies to Aden to emphasize the legitimacy of Hadi's government. But now that the noose around Aden was getting tighter, diplomatic missions left the city. In the end, Hadi disappeared. After a while, it came to light that he had fled the country. Bin Salman decided to keep Hadi in power against the revolutionaries in Yemen for a long time. After the revolutionaries reached the gates of Aden, some developments took place on the Saudi-Yemen border. Saudi Arabia had deployed heavy military equipment on the border with Yemen. Saudi military forces massed along the Yemeni border. Even though Saudi Arabia launched airstrikes every now and then, the ground invasion could expand the war.